where clothing is unnecessary and bananas supposedly fall off the trees. An opposite view is that benign environments leave people free from the constant struggle for existence, free to devote themselves to innovation. 4. There has also been debate over whether technology is stimulated by abundance or by scarcity of environmental resources. Abundant resources might stimulate the development of inventions utilizing those resources, such as watermill technology in rainy northern Europe with its many rivers, but why didn't watermill technology progress more rapidly in even rainier New Guinea? The destruction of Britain's forests has been suggested as the reason behind its early lead in developing coal technology, but why didn't deforestation have the same effect in China? This discussion does not exhaust the list of reasons proposed to explain why societies differ in their receptivity to new technology. Worse yet, all of these proximate explanations bypass the question of the ultimate factors behind them. This may seem like a discouraging setback in our attempt to understand the course of history, since technology has undoubtedly been one of history's strongest forces. However, I shall now argue that the diversity of independent factors behind technological innovation actually makes it easier, not harder, to understand history's broad pattern. For the purposes of this book, the key question about the laundry list is whether such factors differed systematically from continent to continent and thereby led to continental differences in technological development. Most laypeople and many historians assume expressly or tacitly that the answer is yes. For example, it is widely believed that Australian Aborigines as a group shared ideological characteristics contributing to their technological backwardness. They were or are supposedly conservative, living in an imagined past dream time of the world's creation, and not focused on practical ways to improve the present. A leading historian of Africa characterized Africans as inward-looking and lacking Europeans' drive for expansion. But all such claims are based on pure speculation. There has never been a study of many societies under similar socio-economic conditions on each of two continents, demonstrating systematic ideological differences between the two continents' peoples. The usual reasoning is instead circular. Because technological differences exist, the existence of corresponding ideological differences is inferred. In reality, I regularly observe in New Guinea that native societies there differ greatly from each other in their prevalent outlooks. Just like industrialized Europe and America, traditional New Guinea has conservative societies that resist new ways, living side by side with innovative societies that selectively adopt new ways. The result, with the arrival of Western technology, is that the more entrepreneurial societies are now exploiting Western technology to overwhelm their conservative neighbors. For example, when Europeans first reached the highlands of eastern New Guinea in the 1930s, they discovered dozens of previously uncontacted Stone Age tribes, of which the Chimbu tribe proved especially aggressive in adopting Western technology. When Chimbus saw white settlers planting coffee, they began growing coffee themselves as a cash crop. In 1964, I met a 50-year-old Chimbu man, unable to read, wearing a traditional grass skirt, and born into a society still using stone tools, who had become rich by growing coffee, used his profits to buy a sawmill for $100,000 cash, and bought a fleet of trucks to transport his coffee and timber to market. In contrast, a neighboring highland people with whom I worked for 8 years, the Daribi, are especially conservative and uninterested in new technology. When the first helicopter landed in the Daribi area, they briefly looked at it and just went back to what they had been doing. The Chimbus would have been bargaining to charter it. As a result, Chimbus are now moving into the Daribi area, taking it over for plantations and reducing the Daribi to working for them. On every other continent as well, certain native societies have proved very receptive, adopted foreign ways and technology selectively, and integrated them successfully into their own society. In Nigeria, the Igbo people became the local entrepreneurial equivalent of New Guinea's Chimbus. Today, the most numerous Native American tribe in the United States is the Navajo, who on European arrival were just one of several hundred tribes. but the Navajo proved especially resilient and able to deal selectively with innovation. They incorporated Western dyes into their weaving, became silversmiths and ranchers, and now drive trucks while continuing to live in traditional dwellings. Among the supposedly conservative Aboriginal Australians as well, there are receptive societies along with conservative ones. At the one extreme, the Tasmanians continued to use stone tools, superseded tens of thousands of years earlier in Europe, and replaced in most of mainland Australia, too. At the opposite extreme, some Aboriginal fishing groups of southeastern Australia devised elaborate techniques for managing fish populations, including the construction of canals, weirs, and standing traps. Thus, the development and reception of inventions vary enormously from society to society on the same continent. They also vary over time within the same society. Nowadays, Islamic societies in the Middle East are relatively conservative and not at the forefront of technology. But medieval Islam in the same region was technologically advanced and open to innovation. It achieved far higher literacy rates than contemporary Europe. It assimilated the legacy of classical Greek civilization to such a degree that many classical Greek books are now known to us only through Arabic copies. It invented or elaborated windmills, tidal mills, trigonometry, and lateen sails. It made major advances in metallurgy, mechanical and chemical engineering, and irrigation methods. And it adopted paper and gunpowder from China and transmitted them to Europe. In the Middle Ages, the flow of technology was overwhelmingly from Islam to Europe, rather than from Europe to Islam as it is today. Only after around AD 1500 did the net direction of flow begin to reverse. Innovation in China, too, fluctuated markedly with time. Until around AD 1450, China was technologically much more innovative and advanced than Europe, even more so than medieval Islam. The long list of Chinese inventions includes canal lock gates, cast iron, deep drilling, efficient animal harnesses, gunpowder, kites, magnetic compasses, movable type, paper, porcelain, printing, except for the Phaistos disc, sternpost rudders, and wheelbarrows. China then ceased to be innovative for reasons about which we shall speculate in the epilogue. Conversely, we think of Western Europe and its derived North American societies as leading the modern world in technological innovation. But technology was less advanced in Western Europe than in any other civilized area of the Old World until the late Middle Ages. Thus, it is untrue that there are continents whose societies have tended to be innovative and continents whose societies have tended to be conservative. On any continent, at any given time, there are innovative societies and also conservative ones. In addition, receptivity to innovation fluctuates in time within the same region. On reflection, these conclusions are precisely what one would expect if a society's innovativeness is determined by many independent factors. Without a detailed knowledge of all of those factors, innovativeness becomes unpredictable. Hence, social scientists continue to debate the specific reasons why receptivity changed in Islam, China, and Europe, and why the Chimbus, Igbos, and Navajo were more receptive to new technology than were their neighbors. To the student of broad historical patterns, though, it makes no difference what the specific reasons were in each of those cases. The myriad factors affecting innovativeness make the historian's task paradoxically easier, by converting societal variation in innovativeness into essentially a random variable. That means that over a large enough area, such as a whole continent, at any particular time, some proportion of societies is likely to be innovative. Where do innovations actually come from? For all societies except the few past ones that were completely isolated, much or most new technology is not invented locally, but is instead borrowed from other societies. The relative importance of local invention and of borrowing depends mainly on two factors: the ease of invention of the particular technology and the proximity of the particular society to other societies. Some inventions arose straightforwardly from a handling of natural raw materials. Such inventions developed on many independent occasions in world history at different places and times. One example, which we have already considered at length, is plant domestication, with at least 9 independent origins. Another is pottery, which may have arisen from observations of the behavior of clay, a very widespread natural material, when dried or heated. Pottery appeared in Japan around 14,000 years ago, in the Fertile Crescent and China by around 10,000 years ago, and in Amazonia, Africa's Sahel Zone, the U.S. Southeast, and Mexico thereafter. An example of a much more difficult invention is writing, which does not suggest itself by observation of any natural material. As we saw in Chapter 12, it had only a few independent origins, and the alphabet arose, apparently, only once in world history. Other difficult inventions include the water wheel, rotary quern, tooth gearing, magnetic compass, windmill, and camera obscura, all of which were invented only once or twice in the Old World and never in the New World. Such complex inventions were usually acquired by borrowing because they spread more rapidly than they could be independently invented locally. A clear example is the wheel, which is first attested around 3400 BC near the Black Sea, and then turns up within the next few centuries over much of Europe and Asia. All those early Old World wheels are of a peculiar design, a solid wooden circle constructed of 3 planks fastened together, rather than a rim with spokes. In contrast, the sole wheels of Native American societies, depicted on Mexican ceramic vessels, consisted of a single piece, suggesting a second independent invention of the wheel, as one would expect from other evidence for the isolation of New World from Old World civilizations. No one thinks that that same peculiar Old World wheel design appeared repeatedly by chance at many separate sites of the Old World, within a few centuries of each other, after 7 million years of wheelless human history. Instead, the utility of the wheel surely caused it to diffuse rapidly east and west over the Old World from its sole site of invention. Other examples of complex technologies that diffused east and west in the ancient Old World from a single West Asian source include door locks, pulleys, rotary querns, windmills, and the alphabet. A New World example of technological diffusion is metallurgy, which spread from the Andes via Panama to Mesoamerica. When a widely useful invention does crop up in one society, it then tends to spread in either of two ways. One way is that other societies see or learn of the invention, are receptive to it, and adopt it. The second is that societies lacking the invention find themselves at a disadvantage vis-à-vis the inventing society, and they become overwhelmed and replaced if the disadvantage is sufficiently great. A simple example is the spread of muskets among New Zealand's Maori tribes. One tribe, the Ngāpuhi, adopted muskets from European traders around 1818. Over the course of the next 15 years, New Zealand was convulsed by the so-called musket wars, as musketless tribes either acquired muskets or were subjugated by tribes already armed with them. The outcome was that musket technology had spread throughout the whole of New Zealand by 1833. All surviving Maori tribes now had muskets. When societies do adopt a new technology from the society that invented it, the diffusion may occur in many different contexts. They include peaceful trade, as in the spread of transistors from the United States to Japan in 1954, espionage, the smuggling of silkworms from Southeast Asia to the Mideast in AD 552, emigration, the spread of French glass and clothing manufacturing techniques over Europe by the 200,000 Huguenots expelled from France in 1685, and war. A crucial case of the last was the transfer of Chinese papermaking techniques to Islam, made possible when an Arab army defeated a Chinese army at the Battle of Talas River in Central Asia in AD 751, found some papermakers among the prisoners of war, and brought them to Samarkand to set up paper manufacture. In Chapter 12, we saw that cultural diffusion can involve either detailed blueprints or just vague ideas stimulating a reinvention of details. While Chapter 12 illustrated those alternatives for the spread of writing, they also apply to the diffusion of technology. The preceding paragraph gave examples of blueprint copying, whereas the transfer of Chinese porcelain technology to Europe provides an instance of long-drawn-out idea diffusion. Porcelain, a fine-grained translucent pottery, was invented in China around the 7th century A.D. When it began to reach Europe by the Silk Road in the 14th century, with no information about how it was manufactured, it was much admired, and many unsuccessful attempts were made to imitate it. Not until 1707 did the German alchemist Johann Büttger, after lengthy experiments with processes and with mixing various minerals and clays together, hit upon the solution and establish the now famous Meissen porcelain works. More or less independent later experiments in France and England led to Sèvres, Wedgwood, and Spode porcelains. Thus, European potters had to reinvent Chinese manufacturing methods for themselves, but they were stimulated to do so by having models of the desired product before them. Depending on their geographic location, societies differ in how readily they can receive technology by diffusion from other societies. The most isolated people on Earth in recent history were the Aboriginal Tasmanians, living without ocean-going watercraft on an island 100 miles from Australia, itself the most isolated continent. The Tasmanians had no contact with other societies for 10,000 years and acquired no new technology other than what they invented themselves. Australians and New Guineans, separated from the Asian mainland by the Indonesian island chain, received only a trickle of inventions from Asia. The societies most accessible to receiving inventions by diffusion were those embedded in the major continents. In these societies, technology developed most rapidly because they accumulated not only their own inventions, but also those of other societies. For example, medieval Islam, centrally located in Eurasia, acquired inventions from India and China and inherited ancient Greek learning. The importance of diffusion and of geographic location in making it possible is strikingly illustrated by some otherwise incomprehensible cases of societies that abandoned powerful technologies. We tend to assume that useful technologies once acquired inevitably persist until superseded by better ones. In reality, technologies must be not only acquired but also maintained, and that too depends on many unpredictable factors. Any society goes through social movements or fads in which economically useless things become valued or useful things devalued temporarily. Nowadays, when almost all societies on Earth are connected to each other, we cannot imagine a fads going so far that an important technology would actually be discarded. A society that temporarily turned against a powerful technology would continue to see it being used by neighboring societies and would have the opportunity to reacquire it by diffusion, or would be conquered by neighbors if it failed to do so. But such fads can persist in isolated societies. A famous example involves Japan's abandonment of guns. Firearms reached Japan in A.D. 1543, when two Portuguese adventurers, armed with harquebuses, primitive guns, arrived on a Chinese cargo ship. The Japanese were so impressed by the new weapon that they commenced indigenous gun production, greatly improved gun technology, and by AD 1600 owned more and better guns than any other country in the world. But there were also factors working against the acceptance of firearms in Japan. The country had a numerous warrior class, the samurai, for whom swords rated as class symbols and works of art, and as means for subjugating the lower classes. Japanese warfare had previously involved single combats between samurai swordsmen who stood in the open, made ritual speeches, and then took pride in fighting gracefully. Such behavior became lethal in the presence of peasant soldiers ungracefully blasting away with guns. In addition, guns were a foreign invention and grew to be despised, as did other things foreign in Japan after 1600. The samurai-controlled government began by restricting gun production to a few cities, then introduced a requirement of a government license for producing a gun, then issued licenses only for guns produced for the government, and finally reduced government orders for guns until Japan was almost without functional guns again. Contemporary European rulers also included some who despised guns and tried to restrict their availability. But such measures never got far in Europe, where any country that temporarily swore off firearms would be promptly overrun by gun-toting neighboring countries. Only because Japan was a populous, isolated island could it get away with its rejection of the powerful new military technology. Its safety in isolation came to an end in 1853, when the visit of Commodore Perry's U.S. fleet, bristling with cannons, convinced Japan of its need to resume gun manufacture. That rejection and China's abandonment of ocean-going ships as well as of mechanical clocks and water-driven spinning machines are well-known historical instances of technological reversals in isolated or semi-isolated societies. Other such reversals occurred in prehistoric times. The extreme case is that of Aboriginal Tasmanians, who abandoned even bone tools and fishing to become the society with the simplest technology in the modern world. Aboriginal Australians may have adopted and then abandoned bows and arrows. Torres Islanders abandoned canoes, while Gawa Islanders abandoned and then readopted them. Pottery was abandoned throughout Polynesia. Most Polynesians and many Melanesians abandoned the use of bows and arrows in war. Polar Eskimos lost the bow and arrow and the kayak, while Dorset Eskimos lost the bow and arrow, bow drill, and dogs. These examples, at first so bizarre to us, illustrate well the roles of geography and of diffusion in the history of technology. Without diffusion, fewer technologies are acquired, and more existing technologies are lost. Because technology begets more technology, the importance of an invention's diffusion potentially exceeds the importance of the original invention. Technology's history exemplifies what is termed an autocatalytic process, that is, one that speeds up at a rate that increases with time because the process catalyzes itself. The explosion of technology since the Industrial Revolution impresses us today, but the medieval explosion was equally impressive compared with that of the Bronze Age, which in turn dwarfed that of the Upper Paleolithic. One reason why technology tends to catalyze itself is that advances depend upon previous mastery of simpler problems. For example, Stone Age farmers did not proceed directly to extracting and working iron, which requires high-temperature furnaces. Instead, iron ore metallurgy grew out of thousands of years of human experience with natural outcrops of pure metals soft enough to be hammered into shape without heat, copper and gold. It also grew out of thousands of years of development of simple furnaces to make pottery, and then to extract copper ores and work copper alloys, bronzes, that do not require as high temperatures as does iron. In both the Fertile Crescent and China, iron objects become common only after about 2,000 years of experience of bronze metallurgy. New World societies had just begun making bronze artifacts and had not yet started making iron ones at the time when the arrival of Europeans truncated the New World's independent trajectory. The other main reason for autocatalysis is that new technologies and materials make it possible to generate still other new technologies by recombination. For instance, why did printing spread explosively in medieval Europe after Gutenberg printed his Bible in AD 1455, but not after that unknown printer printed the Phaistos disc in 1700 BC? The explanation is partly that medieval European printers were able to combine six technological advances, most of which were unavailable to the maker of the Phaistos disc. Of those advances in paper, movable type, metallurgy, presses, inks, and scripts, paper and the idea of movable type reached Europe from China. Gutenberg's development of typecasting from metal dies to overcome the potentially fatal problem of non-uniform type size depended on many metallurgical developments. Steel for letter punches, brass or bronze alloys, later replaced by steel, for dies, lead for molds, and a tin-zinc-lead alloy for type. Gutenberg's press was derived from screw presses in use for making wine and olive oil, while his ink was an oil-based improvement on existing inks. The alphabetic scripts that medieval Europe inherited from three millennia of alphabet development lent themselves to printing with movable type, because only a few dozen letter forms had to be cast, as opposed to the thousands of signs required for Chinese writing. In all six respects, the maker of the Phaistos disk had access to much less powerful technologies to combine into a printing system than did Gutenberg. The disk's writing medium was clay, which is much bulkier and heavier than paper. The metallurgical skills, inks, and presses of 1700 BC, Crete, were more primitive than those of AD 1455 Germany. So the disk had to be punched by hand, rather than by cast, movable type, locked into a metal frame, inked, and pressed. The disk script was a syllabary with more signs, of more complex form, than the Roman alphabet used by Gutenberg. As a result, the Phaistos disk's printing technology was much clumsier, and offered fewer advantages over writing by hand than Gutenberg's printing press. In addition to all those technological drawbacks, the Phaistos disk was printed at a time when knowledge of writing was confined to a few palace or temple scribes. Hence there was little demand for the disk maker's beautiful product, and little incentive to invest in making the dozens of hand punches required. In contrast, the potential mass market for printing in medieval Europe induced numerous investors to lend money to Gutenberg. Human technology developed from the first stone tools, in use by 2.5 million years ago, to the 1996 laser printer that replaced my already outdated 1992 laser printer and that was used to print this book's manuscript. The rate of development was undetectably slow at the beginning, when hundreds of thousands of years passed with no discernible change in our stone tools, and with no surviving evidence for artifacts made of other materials. Today, technology advances so rapidly that it is reported in the daily newspaper. In this long history of accelerating development, one can single out two especially significant jumps. The first, occurring between 100,000 and 50,000 years ago, probably was made possible by genetic changes in our bodies, namely, by evolution of the modern anatomy permitting modern speech or modern brain function, or both. That jump led to bone tools, single-purpose stone tools, and compound tools. The second jump resulted from our adoption of a sedentary lifestyle, which happened at different times in different parts of the world, as early as 13,000 years ago, in some areas, and not even today, in others. For the most part, that adoption was linked to our adoption of food production, which required us to remain close to our crops, orchards, and stored food surpluses. Sedentary living was decisive for the history of technology, because it enabled people to accumulate non-portable possessions. Nomadic hunter-gatherers are limited to technology that can be carried. If you move often and lack vehicles or draft animals, you confine your possessions to babies, weapons, and a bare minimum of other absolute necessities small enough to carry. You can't be burdened with pottery and printing presses as you shift camp. That practical difficulty probably explains the tantalizingly early appearance of some technologies, followed by a long delay in their further development. For example, the earliest attested precursors of ceramics are fired clay figurines made in the area of modern Czechoslovakia 27,000 years ago, long before the oldest known fired clay vessels from Japan 14,000 years ago. The same area of Czechoslovakia at the same time has yielded the earliest evidence for weaving, otherwise not attested until the oldest known basket appears around 13,000 years ago and the oldest known woven cloth around 9,000 years ago. Despite these very early first steps, neither pottery nor weaving took off until people became sedentary and thereby escaped the problem of transporting pots and looms. Besides permitting sedentary living and hence the accumulation of possessions, food production was decisive in the history of technology for another reason. It became possible for the first time in human evolution to develop economically specialized societies consisting of non-food-producing specialists fed by food-producing peasants. But we already saw in Part 2 of this book that food production arose at different times in different continents. In addition, as we've seen in this chapter, local technology depends for both its origin and its maintenance not only on local invention, but also on the diffusion of technology from elsewhere. That consideration tended to cause technology to develop most rapidly on continents with few geographic and ecological barriers to diffusion, either within that continent or on other continents. Finally, each society on a continent represents one more opportunity to invent and adopt a technology, because societies vary greatly in their innovativeness for many separate reasons. Hence, all other things being equal, technology develops fastest in large productive regions with large human populations, many potential inventors, and many competing societies. Let us now summarize how variations in these three factors, time of onset of food production, barriers to diffusion, and human population size, led straightforwardly to the observed intercontinental differences in the development of technology. Eurasia, effectively including North Africa, is the world's largest landmass, encompassing the largest number of competing societies. It was also the landmass with the two centers where food production began the earliest, the Fertile Crescent and China. Its east-west major axis permitted many inventions adopted in one part of Eurasia to spread relatively rapidly to societies at similar latitudes and climates elsewhere in Eurasia. Its breadth along its minor axis, north-south, contrasts with the Americas' narrowness at the Isthmus of Panama. It lacks the severe ecological barriers transecting the major axes of the Americas and Africa. Thus, geographic and ecological barriers to diffusion of technology were less severe in Eurasia than in other continents. Thanks to all these factors, Eurasia was the continent on which technology started its post-Pleistocene acceleration earliest and resulted in the greatest local accumulation of technologies. North and South America are conventionally regarded as separate continents, but they have been connected for several million years, pose similar historical problems, and may be considered together for comparison with Eurasia. The Americas form the world's second-largest landmass, significantly smaller than Eurasia. However, they are fragmented by geography and by ecology. The Isthmus of Panama, only 40 miles wide, virtually transects the Americas geographically, as do the Isthmus's Darien rainforests and the northern Mexican desert ecologically. The latter desert separated advanced human societies of Mesoamerica from those of North America, while the Isthmus separated advanced societies of Mesoamerica from those of the Andes and Amazonia. In addition, the main axis of the Americas is north-south, forcing most diffusion to go against a gradient of latitude and climate rather than to operate within the same latitude. For example, wheels were invented in Mesoamerica, and llamas were domesticated in the central Andes by 3000 BC. But 5,000 years later, the Americas' sole beast of burden and sole wheels had still not encountered each other, even though the distance separating Mesoamerica's Maya societies from the northern border of the Inca Empire, 1,200 miles, was far less than the 6,000 miles separating wheel and horse-sharing France and China. Those factors seem to me to account for the Americas' technological lag behind Eurasia. Sub-Saharan Africa is the world's third-largest landmass, considerably smaller than the Americas. Throughout most of human history, it was far more accessible to Eurasia than were the Americas. But the Saharan Desert is still a major ecological barrier separating sub-Saharan Africa from Eurasia plus North Africa. Africa's north-south axis posed a further obstacle to the diffusion of technology, both between Eurasia and sub-Saharan Africa, and within the sub-Saharan region itself. As an illustration of the latter obstacle, pottery and iron metallurgy arose in or reached sub-Saharan Africa's Sahel zone, north of the equator, at least as early as they reached Western Europe. However, pottery did not reach the southern tip of Africa until around AD 1, and metallurgy had not yet diffused overland to the southern tip by the time that it arrived there from Europe on ships. Finally, Australia is the smallest continent. The very low rainfall and productivity of most of Australia makes it effectively even smaller as regards its capacity to support human populations. It is also the most isolated continent. In addition, food production never arose indigenously in Australia. Those factors combined to leave Australia the sole continent without metal artifacts in modern times. Let's compare the continents with respect to their areas and their modern human populations. The continent's populations 10,000 years ago, just before the rise of food production, are not known, but surely stood in the same sequence, since many of the areas producing the most food today would also have been productive areas for hunter-gatherers 10,000 years ago. The differences in population are glaring. Eurasia's, including North Africa's, is nearly 6 times that of the Americas, nearly 8 times that of Africa's, and 230 times that of Australia's. Larger populations mean more inventors and more competing societies. This by itself goes a long way toward explaining the origins of guns and steel in Eurasia. All these effects that continental differences in area, population, ease of diffusion, and onset of food production exerted on the rise of technology became exaggerated, because technology catalyzes itself. Eurasia's considerable initial advantage thereby was translated into a huge lead as of AD 1492, for reasons of Eurasia's distinctive geography rather than of distinctive human intellect. The New Guineans whom I know include potential Edisons, but they directed their ingenuity toward technological problems appropriate to their situations, the problems of surviving without any imported items in the New Guinea jungle, rather than the problem of inventing phonographs. Chapter 14. From Egalitarianism to Kleptocracy. In 1979, while I was flying with missionary friends over a remote swamp-filled basin of New Guinea, I noticed a few huts many miles apart. The pilot explained to me that, somewhere in that muddy expanse below us, a group of Indonesian crocodile hunters had recently come across a group of New Guinea nomads. Both groups had panicked, and the encounter had ended with the Indonesians shooting several of the nomads. My missionary friends guessed that the nomads belonged to an uncontacted group called the Fayu, known to the outside world only through accounts by their terrified neighbors, a missionized group of erstwhile nomads called the Kirikiri. First contacts between outsiders and New Guinea groups are always potentially dangerous, but this beginning was especially inauspicious. Nevertheless, my friend Doug flew in by helicopter to try to establish friendly relations with the Fayu. He returned, alive but shaken, to tell a remarkable story. It turned out that the Fayu normally lived as single families, scattered through the swamp, and coming together once or twice each year to negotiate exchanges of brides. Doug's visit coincided with such a gathering of a few dozen Fayu. To us, a few dozen people constitute a small, ordinary gathering. But to the Fayu, it was a rare, frightening event. Murderers suddenly found themselves face to face with their victims' relatives. For example, one Fayu man spotted the man who had killed his father. The son raised his axe and rushed at the murderer, but was wrestled to the ground by friends. Then the murderer came at the prostrate son with an axe and was also wrestled down. Both men were held, screaming in rage, until they seemed sufficiently exhausted to be released. Other men periodically shouted insults at each other, shook with anger and frustration, and pounded the ground with their axes. That tension continued for the several days of the gathering, while Doug prayed that the visit would not end in violence. The Fayu consist of about 400 hunter-gatherers, divided into 4 clans, and wandering over a few hundred square miles. According to their own account, they had formerly numbered about 2,000, but their population had been greatly reduced as a result of Fayu killing Fayu. They lacked political and social mechanisms, which we take for granted, to achieve peaceful resolution of serious disputes. Eventually, as a result of Doug's visit, one group of Fayu invited a courageous husband and wife missionary couple to live with them. The couple has now resided there for a dozen years and gradually persuaded the Fayu to renounce violence. The Fayu are thereby being brought into the modern world where they face an uncertain future. Many other previously uncontacted groups of New Guineans and Amazonians have similarly owed to missionaries their incorporation into modern society. After the missionaries come teachers and doctors, bureaucrats and soldiers. The spreads of government and of religion have thus been linked to each other throughout recorded history, whether the spread has been peaceful, as eventually with the Fayu, or by force. In the latter case, it is often government that organizes the conquest, and religion that justifies it. While nomads and tribespeople occasionally defeat organized governments and religions, the trend over the past 13,000 years has been for the nomads and tribespeople to lose. At the end of the last ice age, much of the world's population lived in societies similar to that of the Fayu today, and no people then lived in a much more complex society. As recently as AD 1500, less than 20% of the world's land area was marked off by boundaries into states run by bureaucrats and governed by laws. Today, all land except Antarctica's is so divided. Descendants of those societies that achieved centralized government and organized religion earliest ended up dominating the modern world. The combination of government and religion has thus functioned, together with germs, writing, and technology, as one of the four main sets of proximate agents leading to history's broadest pattern. How did government and religion arise? Fayu bands and modern states represent opposite extremes along the spectrum of human societies. Modern American society and the Fayu differ in the presence or absence of a professional police force, cities, money, distinctions between rich and poor, and many other political, economic, and social institutions. Did all of those institutions arise together, or did some arise before others? We can infer the answer to this question by comparing modern societies at different levels of organization, by examining written accounts or archaeological evidence about past societies, and by observing how a society's institutions change over time. Cultural anthropologists attempting to describe the diversity of human societies often divide them into as many as half a dozen categories. Any such attempt to define stages of any evolutionary or developmental continuum, whether of musical styles, human life stages, or human societies, is doubly doomed to imperfection. First, because each stage grows out of some previous stage, the lines of demarcation are inevitably arbitrary. For example, is a 19-year-old person an adolescent or a young adult? Second, developmental sequences are not invariant, so examples pigeonholed under the same stage are inevitably heterogeneous. Brahms and Liszt would turn in their graves to know that they are now grouped together as composers of the Romantic period. Nevertheless, arbitrarily delineated stages provide a useful shorthand for discussing the diversity of music and of human societies, provided one bears in mind the above caveats. In that spirit, we shall use a simple classification based on just four categories, band, tribe, chiefdom, and state, to understand societies. Bands are the tiniest societies, consisting typically of 5 to 80 people, most or all of them close relatives by birth or by marriage. In effect, a band is an extended family, or several related extended families. Today, bands still living autonomously are almost confined to the most remote parts of New Guinea and Amazonia, but within modern times there were many others that have only recently fallen under state control or been assimilated or exterminated. They include many or most African pygmies, southern African San hunter-gatherers, so-called bushmen, aboriginal Australians, Eskimos, Inuit, and Indians of some resource-poor areas of the Americas, such as Tierra del Fuego and the northern boreal forests. All those modern bands are or were nomadic hunter-gatherers rather than settled food producers. Probably all humans lived in bands until at least 40,000 years ago, and most still did as recently as 11,000 years ago. Bands lack many institutions that we take for granted in our own society. They have no permanent single base of residence. The band's land is used jointly by the whole group, instead of being partitioned among subgroups or individuals. There is no regular economic specialization, except by age and sex. All able-bodied individuals forage for food. There are no formal institutions, such as laws, police, and treaties, to resolve conflicts within and between bands. Band organization is often described as egalitarian. There is no formalized social stratification into upper and lower classes, no formalized or hereditary leadership, and no formalized monopolies of information and decision-making. However, the term egalitarian should not be taken to mean that all band members are equal in prestige and contribute equally to decisions. Rather, the term merely means that any band leadership is informal and acquired through qualities such as personality, strength, intelligence, and fighting skills. My own experience with bands comes from the swampy lowland area of New Guinea, where the Fayu live, a region known as the Lakes Plains. There, I still encounter extended families of a few adults, with their dependent children and elderly, living in crude temporary shelters along streams and traveling by canoe and on foot. Why do people of the Lakes Plains continue to live as nomadic bands, when most other New Guinea peoples, and almost all of their peoples elsewhere in the world, now live in settled larger groups? The explanation is that the region lacks dense local concentrations of resources that would permit many people to live together, and that, until the arrival of missionaries bringing crop plants, it also lacked native plants that could have permitted productive farming. The band's food staple is the sago palm tree, whose core yields a starchy pith when the palm reaches maturity. The bands are nomadic, because they must move when they have cut the mature sago trees in an area. Band numbers are kept low by diseases, especially malaria, by the lack of raw materials in the swamp. Even stone for tools must be obtained by trade, and by the limited amount of food that the swamp yields for humans. Similar limitations on the resources accessible to existing human technology prevail in the regions of the world recently occupied by other bands. Our closest animal relatives, the gorillas and chimpanzees and bonobos of Africa, also live in bands. All humans presumably did so too, until improved technology for extracting food allowed some hunter-gatherers to settle in permanent dwellings in some resource-rich areas. The band is the political, economic, and social organization that we inherited from our millions of years of evolutionary history. Our developments beyond it all took place within the last few tens of thousands of years. The first of those stages beyond the band is termed the tribe, which differs in being larger, typically comprising hundreds rather than dozens of people, and usually having fixed settlements. However, some tribes and even chiefdoms consist of herders who move seasonally. Tribal organization is exemplified by New Guinea Highlanders, whose political unit before the arrival of colonial government was a village, or else a close-knit cluster of villages. This political definition of tribe is thus often much smaller than what linguists and cultural anthropologists would define as a tribe, namely a group that shares language and culture. For example, in 1964, I began to work among a group of Highlanders known as the Foray. By linguistic and cultural standards, there were then 12,000 Foray speaking two mutually intelligible dialects and living in 65 villages of several hundred people each. But there was no political unity whatsoever among villages of the Foray language group. Each hamlet was involved in a kaleidoscopically changing pattern of war and shifting alliances with all neighboring hamlets, regardless of whether the neighbors were Foray or speakers of a different language. Tribes, recently independent and now variously subordinated to national states, still occupy much of New Guinea, Melanesia, and Amazonia. Similar tribal organization in the past is inferred from archaeological evidence of settlements that were substantial but lacked the archaeological hallmarks of chiefdoms that I shall explain below. That evidence suggests that tribal organization began to emerge around 13,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent and later in some other areas. A prerequisite for living in settlements is either food production or else a productive environment with especially concentrated resources that can be hunted and gathered within a small area. That's why settlements, and by inference tribes, began to proliferate in the Fertile Crescent at that time, when climate changes and improved technology combined to permit abundant harvests of wild cereals. Besides differing from a band by virtue of its settled residence and its larger numbers, a tribe also differs in that it consists of more than one formally recognized kinship group, termed clans, which exchange marriage partners. Land belongs to a particular clan, not to the whole tribe. However, the number of people in a tribe is still low enough that everyone knows everyone else by name and relationship. For other types of human groups as well, a few hundred seems to be an upper limit for group size compatible with everyone's knowing everybody. In our state society, for instance, school principals are likely to know all their students by name if the school contains a few hundred children, but not if it contains a few thousand children. One reason why the organization of human government tends to change from that of a tribe to that of a chiefdom in societies with more than a few hundred members is that the difficult issue of conflict resolution between strangers becomes increasingly acute in larger groups. A fact further diffusing potential problems of conflict resolution in tribes is that almost everyone is related to everyone else, by blood, or marriage, or both. Those ties of relationships binding all tribal members make police, laws, and other conflict-resolving institutions of larger societies unnecessary, since any two villagers getting into an argument will share many kin, who apply pressure on them to keep it from becoming violent. In traditional New Guinea society, if a New Guinean happened to encounter an unfamiliar New Guinean while both were away from their respective villages, the two engaged in a long discussion of their relatives, in an attempt to establish some relationship, and hence some reason why the two should not attempt to kill each other. Despite all of these differences between bands and tribes, many similarities remain. Tribes still have an informal egalitarian system of government. Information and decision-making are both communal. In the New Guinea highlands, I have watched village meetings where all adults in the village were present, sitting on the ground, and individuals made speeches, without any appearance of one person's chairing the discussion. Many highland villages do have someone known as the big man, the most influential man of the village. But that position is not a formal office to be filled and carries only limited power. The big man has no independent decision-making authority, knows no diplomatic secrets, and can do no more than attempt to sway communal decisions. Big men achieve that status by their own attributes. The position is not inherited. Tribes also share with bands an egalitarian social system, without ranked lineages or classes. Not only is status not inherited, no member of a traditional tribe or band can become disproportionately wealthy by his or her own efforts, because each individual has debts and obligations to many others. It is therefore impossible for an outsider to guess, from appearances, which of all the adult men in a village is the big man. He lives in the same type of hut, wears the same clothes or ornaments, or is as naked as everyone else. Like bands, tribes lack a bureaucracy, police force, and taxes. Their economy is based on reciprocal exchanges between individuals or families, rather than on a redistribution of tribute paid to some central authority. Economic specialization is slight. Full-time craft specialists are lacking, and every able-bodied adult, including the big man, participates in growing, gathering, or hunting food. I recall one occasion when I was walking past a garden in the Solomon Islands, saw a man digging and waving at me in the distance, and realized, to my astonishment, that it was a friend of mine named Falatau. He was the most famous woodcarver of the Solomons, an artist of great originality, but that did not free him of the necessity to grow his own sweet potatoes. Since tribes thus lack economic specialists, they also lack slaves, because there are no specialized menial jobs for a slave to perform. Just as musical composers of the classical period range from C.P.E. Bach to Schubert, and thereby cover the whole spectrum from Baroque composers to Romantic composers, tribes also shade into bands at one extreme and into chiefdoms at the opposite extreme. In particular, a tribal big man's role in dividing the meat of pigs slaughtered for feasts points to the role of chiefs in collecting and redistributing food and goods, now reconstrued as tribute in chiefdoms. Similarly, presence or absence of public architecture is supposedly one of the distinctions between tribes and chiefdoms. But large New Guinea villages often have cult houses, known as House Tamboran on the Sepik River, that presage the temples of chiefdoms. Although a few bands and tribes survive today on remote and ecologically marginal lands outside state control, fully independent chiefdoms had disappeared by the early 20th century because they tended to occupy prime land coveted by states. However, as of AD 1492, chiefdoms were still widespread over much of the eastern United States, in productive areas of South and Central America, and sub-Saharan Africa that had not yet been subsumed under native states, and in all of Polynesia. The archaeological evidence discussed below suggests that chiefdoms arose by around 5500 BC in the Fertile Crescent, and by around 1000 BC in Mesoamerica and the Andes. Let us consider the distinctive features of chiefdoms, very different from modern European and American states, and at the same time, from bands and simple tribal societies. As regards population size, chiefdoms were considerably larger than tribes, ranging from several thousand to several tens of thousands of people. That size created serious potential for internal conflict because, for any person living in a chiefdom, the vast majority of other people in the chiefdom were neither closely related by blood or marriage, nor known by name. With the rise of chiefdoms around 7,500 years ago, people had to learn, for the first time in history, how to encounter strangers regularly without attempting to kill them. Part of the solution to that problem was for one person, the chief, to exercise a monopoly on the right to use force. In contrast to a tribe's big man, a chief held a recognized office, filled by hereditary right. Instead of the decentralized anarchy of a village meeting, the chief was a permanent centralized authority, made all significant decisions, and had a monopoly on critical information, such as what a neighboring chief was privately threatening or what harvest the gods had supposedly promised. Unlike big men, chiefs could be recognized from afar by visible distinguishing features, such as a large fan worn over the back on Rennell Island in the Southwest Pacific. A commoner encountering a chief was obliged to perform ritual marks of respect, such as, on Hawaii, prostrating oneself. The chief's orders might be transmitted through one or two levels of bureaucrats, many of whom were themselves low-ranked chiefs. However, in contrast to state bureaucrats, chiefdom bureaucrats had generalized rather than specialized roles. In Polynesian Hawaii, the same bureaucrats, termed konohiki, extracted tribute and oversaw irrigation and organized labor corvées for the chief. Whereas state societies have separate tax collectors, water district managers, and draft boards. A chiefdom's large population in a small area required plenty of food, obtained by food production in most cases, by hunting-gathering in a few especially rich areas. For example, American Indians of the Pacific Northwest coast, such as the Kwaikutl, Nootka, and Tlingit Indians, lived under chiefs in villages without any agriculture or domestic animals, because the rivers and sea were so rich in salmon and halibut. The food surpluses generated by some people, relegated to the rank of commoners, went to feed the chiefs, their families, bureaucrats, and crafts specialists, who variously made canoes, adzes, or spittoons, or worked as bird catchers or tattooers. Luxury goods consisting of those specialized crafts, products, or else rare objects obtained by long-distance trade were reserved for chiefs. For example, Hawaiian chiefs had feather cloaks, some of them consisting of tens of thousands of feathers and requiring many human generations for their manufacture, by commoner cloakmakers, of course. That concentration of luxury goods often makes it possible to recognize chiefdoms archaeologically, by the fact that some graves, those of chiefs, contain much richer goods than other graves, those of commoners, in contrast to the egalitarian burials of earlier human history. Some ancient complex chiefdoms can also be distinguished from tribal villages by the remains of elaborate public architecture, such as temples, and by a regional hierarchy of settlements, with one site, the site of the paramount chief, being obviously larger and having more administrative buildings and artifacts than other sites. Like tribes, chiefdoms consisted of multiple hereditary lineages, living at one site. However, whereas the lineages of tribal villages are equal-ranked clans, in a chiefdom, all members of the chief's lineage had hereditary prerequisites. In effect, the society was divided into hereditary chief and commoner classes, with Hawaiian chiefs themselves subdivided into 8 hierarchically ranked lineages, each concentrating its marriages within its own lineage. Furthermore, since chiefs required menial servants as well as specialized craftspeople, chiefdoms differed from tribes in having many jobs that could be filled by slaves, typically obtained by capture in raids. The most distinctive economic feature of chiefdoms was their shift from reliance solely on the reciprocal exchanges, characteristic of bands and tribes, by which A gives B a gift while expecting that B at some unspecified future time will give a gift of comparable value to A. We modern state dwellers indulge in such behavior on birthdays and holidays, but most of our flow of goods is achieved instead by buying and selling for money according to the law of supply and demand. While continuing reciprocal exchanges and without marketing or money, chiefdoms developed an additional new system termed a redistributive economy. A simple example would involve a chief receiving wheat at harvest time from every farmer in the chiefdom, then throwing a feast for everybody, and serving bread or else storing the wheat and gradually giving it out again in the months between harvests. When a large portion of the goods received from commoners was not redistributed to them, but was retained and consumed by the chiefly lineages and craftspeople, the redistribution became tribute, a precursor of taxes that made its first appearance in chiefdoms. From the commoners, the chiefs claimed not only goods but also labor for construction of public works, which again might return to benefit the commoners, for example, irrigation systems to help feed everybody, or instead benefited mainly the chiefs, for instance, lavish tombs. We have been talking about chiefdoms generically as if they were all the same. In fact, chiefdoms varied considerably. Larger ones tended to have more powerful chiefs, more ranks of chiefly lineages, greater distinctions between chiefs and commoners, more retention of tribute by the chiefs, more layers of bureaucrats, and grander public architecture. For instance, societies on small Polynesian islands were effectively rather similar to tribal societies with a big man, except that the position of chief was hereditary. The chief's hut looked like any other hut. There were no bureaucrats or public works. The chief redistributed most goods he received back to the commoners, and land was controlled by the community. But on the largest Polynesian islands, such as Hawaii, Tahiti, and Tonga, chiefs were recognizable at a glance by their ornaments. Public works were erected by large labor forces. Most tribute was retained by the chiefs, and all land was controlled by them. A further gradation among societies with ranked lineages was from those where the political unit was a single autonomous village, to those consisting of a regional assemblage of villages in which the largest village, with a paramount chief, controlled the smaller villages with lesser chiefs. By now it should be obvious that chiefdoms introduce the dilemma fundamental to all centrally governed, non-egalitarian societies. At best, they do good by providing expensive services impossible to contract for on an individual basis. At worst, they function unabashedly as kleptocracies, transferring net wealth from commoners to upper classes. These noble and selfish functions are inextricably linked, although some governments emphasize much more of one function than of the other. The difference between a kleptocrat and a wise statesman, between a robber baron and a public benefactor, is merely one of degree, a matter of just how large a percentage of the tribute extracted from producers is retained by the elite, and how much the commoners like the public uses to which the redistributed tribute is put. We consider President Mobutu of Zaire a kleptocrat because he keeps too much tribute, the equivalent of billions of dollars, and redistributes too little tribute, no functioning telephone system in Zaire. We consider George Washington a statesman because he spent tax money on widely admired programs and did not enrich himself as president. Nevertheless, George Washington was born into wealth, which is much more unequally distributed in the United States than in New Guinea villages. For any ranked society, whether a chiefdom or a state, one thus has to ask, why do the commoners tolerate the transfer of the fruits of their hard labor to kleptocrats? This question, raised by political theorists from Plato to Marx, is raised anew by voters in every modern election. Kleptocracies with little public support run the risk of being overthrown, either by downtrodden commoners or by upstart would-be replacement kleptocrats seeking public support by promising a higher ratio of services rendered to fruit stolen. For example, Hawaiian history was repeatedly punctuated by revolts against repressive chiefs, usually led by younger brothers, promising less oppression. This may sound funny to us in the context of old Hawaii, until we reflect on all the misery still being caused by such struggles in the modern world. What should an elite do to gain popular support while still maintaining a more comfortable lifestyle than commoners? Kleptocrats throughout the ages have resorted to a mixture of four solutions. 1. Disarm the populace and arm the elite. That's much easier in these days of high-tech weaponry, produced only in industrial plants, and easily monopolized by an elite than in ancient times of spears and clubs easily made at home. 2. Make the masses happy by redistributing much of the tribute received in popular ways. This principle was as valid for Hawaiian chiefs as it is for American politicians today. 3. Use the monopoly of force to promote happiness by maintaining public order and curbing violence. This is potentially a big and underappreciated advantage of centralized societies over non-centralized ones. Anthropologists formerly idealized band and tribal societies as gentle and nonviolent, because visiting anthropologists observed no murder in a band of 25 people in the course of a 3-year study. Of course, they didn't. It's easy to calculate that a band of a dozen adults and a dozen children, subject to the inevitable deaths occurring anyway for the usual reasons other than murder, could not perpetuate itself if, in addition, one of its dozen adults murdered another adult every 3 years. Much more extensive long-term information about band and tribal societies reveals that murder is a leading cause of death. For example, I happened to be visiting New Guinea's Iyao people at a time when a woman anthropologist was interviewing Iyao women about their life histories. Woman after woman, when asked to name her husband, named several sequential husbands who had died violent deaths. A typical answer went like this, quote, "My first husband was killed by Elope raiders. My second husband was killed by a man who wanted me, and who became my third husband. That husband was killed by the brother of my second husband, seeking to avenge his murder," end quote. Such biographies proved common for so-called gentle tribespeople and contributed to the acceptance of centralized authority as tribal societies grew larger. 4. The remaining way for kleptocrats to gain public support is to construct an ideology or religion justifying kleptocracy. Bands and tribes already had supernatural beliefs, just as do modern established religions. But the supernatural beliefs of bands and tribes did not serve to justify central authority, justify transfer of wealth, or maintain peace between unrelated individuals. When supernatural beliefs gained those functions and became institutionalized, they were thereby transformed into what we term a religion. Hawaiian chiefs were typical of chiefs elsewhere in asserting divinity, divine descent, or at least a hotline to the gods. The chief claimed to serve the people by interceding for them with the gods and reciting the ritual formulas required to obtain rain, good harvests, and success in fishing. Chiefdoms characteristically have an ideology, precursor to an institutionalized religion, that buttresses the chief's authority. The chief may either combine the offices of political leader and priest in a single person, or may support a separate group of kleptocrats, that is, priests, whose function is to provide ideological justification for the chiefs. That is why chiefdoms devote so much collected tribute to constructing temples.